The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reminisce magazine. Now, when I give you the following game piece items, tell me what comes to mind. Top hat, ship, dog, thimble, shoe, house and rider, cannon, iron, wheelbarrow, race car. You got it. All of us have played this game many, many times, I believe. It's Monopoly, and here are some fun facts. And the title of the article is Monopoly Makers Go to the Bank, Not Jail. The day when Charles B. Darrow of Germantown, Pennsylvania, drew a game board on a piece of oilcloth in his kitchen table in 1933, he fell in love with the concept. The United States was mired in the Great Depression, and the new game's promise of fame and fortune, a vicarious get-rich-quick competition, would prove extremely appealing. As Darrow showed friends his creation, they wanted their own copies. He had trouble keeping up with the demand. In 1934, he tried to sell the game to Parker Brothers, a well-known toy and game manufacturer. Citing 52 design errors, the company said no. Undaunted, Darrow returned home and continued to produce handmade editions, selling 5,000 of the games to a Philadelphia department store. In 1935, when Parker Brothers heard about Darrow's success, they decided to buy the rights to the game after all. Since then, more than 200 million Monopoly games have been sold worldwide. The game is licensed in 80 countries and made in 26 languages. An estimated 500 million people have played the game. Open a new Monopoly game box and you'll find 20 $500 bills, which are orange, 20 $100 bills, which are beige, 30 $50 green bills, 50 $20 blue bills, and 40 $10 bills, which are yellow, 40 $5 bills in pink, and 40 $1 bills in white. Total money in the game is $15,140, and Parker Brothers prints about $50 billion in Monopoly money a year. The property values are the same as when Parker Brothers first published the game, although the taxes changed a bit in 1936. What were the player tokens in the first Monopoly games? Raspberry sounds. Sorry, trick questions. The first games had no tokens. Players were told to use common household items, such as buttons, coins, and thimbles. When Parker Brothers bought the game, it offered a thimble, iron, shoe, cannon, top hat, battleship, and doctor's bag metal tokens. The deluxe game version added others. In the early days, Monopoly, as well as other board games, was offered in small box board separate and deluxe versions. The tokens were inspired by charms from bracelets and Cracker Jack prizes. According to Phil Orbanes, the world-leading authority on Monopoly and author of The Game Makers. Wooden tokens have included in the games for several years. At one point, molded plastic tokens, which could be mistaken for rubber, were used experimentally. Consumers preferred metal tokens, however. World War II and the conservation of strategic metals resulted in a change back to wooden tokens. During the war, Monopoly games sent to POW camps in Germany included escape maps, compasses, files, and real money slipped into packs of Monopoly money. Today, there are dozens of versions of Monopoly, many tied to a specific product such as Coca-Cola, Betty Boop, I Love Lucy, John Deere tractors, Looney Tunes, and sports teams. One set made by Alfred Dunhill included gold houses and silver hotels. It sold for $25,000. The longest game known lasted 70 straight days, and one game in a bathtub lasted 99 hours. The longest game underwater lasted 45 days. Wow, what a story about how we all love Monopoly and how it got to be. Very good for Remnants Magazine today. Checking a couple of things here on the spotlight, and I think we may have touched upon this story once before, but I think it looks like an idea that's come about. But before we get to that, how about a time capsule? In 1973, some interesting things among this time capsule. January 3rd, CBS sells Yankees for $10 million to a syndicate led by George Steinbrenner. Wow, what a deal that was, wasn't it? January 14th, Aloha, Elvis Presley's concert in Hawaii is the first worldwide telecast by an individual entertainer. And on January 16th, NBC broadcast the 431st and final episode of Bonanza. That was a great, great program, and we all enjoyed that, I'm sure. Skipping a little bit down the line, in February of 27, members of the Ogallala Lakota tribe and the American Indian Movement occupy Wounded Knee, South Dakota, demanding that the U.S. honor its treaties. On March 14th, POW and future U.S. Senator John McCain is released from the Vietnamese prison. How long do you think Federal Express has been in business? 1973, April 17th. Federal Express top launches its 14 aircraft from Memphis, Tennessee Airport. And that was a not accepted paper by the founder of that company when he was going to college. But look where it is today. And the one we talked about just a moment ago, game, set, match, occurred on September 20th, 1973, when Billie Jean King defeats Bobby Riggs in a televised tennis match nicknamed the Battle of the Sexes. The game remains the highest attended tennis match in U.S. history, and some 90 million TV viewers also watched King win. How about that? What another icon that came along? It guessed about the Golden Arches. The name of the story is Diners, Drive-Thrus, and McDonald's. The past is just around the corner. This is by Sherry Visit of Monongahela, Pennsylvania. She writes, after posting a request on Facebook for a photo of the Cottage Diner, my favorite place to eat growing up in the 70s in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, I was flooded with stories. One person shared a hilarious tale from his early teens when, during a sleepover, he and his friends snuck into the alley behind the diner at 4 a.m. and heisted pies out of the back of the delivery truck. Many remembered having a sandwich at the diner after a movie at the Star Theater just around the corner. Nearby, Frank's Fruit Market sold beautifully wrapped fruit baskets and Christmas trees in the open plaza. A taxi stand and a Greyhound stop next door meant you could grab a snack and the diner while waiting for the bus. The memories go back to the 50s when my mom went there. During redevelopment in the 80s, the entire block was wiped out. A shiny McDonald's now stands in place of the diner. Its owner has become a generous community member. My children and I hit the drive-thru whenever we crave a Big Mac and a sweet, thick shake. But so many images of the old diner stay with me. I share them with my children, but they can't know the pleasure we took in that not-so-perfect architecture, the not-so-comfortable wooden booths, the not-so-healthy fries cooked in pots of well-used grease, or the not-so-pleasant whiff of ripe produce through the open diner window on a warm summer day. And that's reminiscing there by Sherry Visiewit of Monongahela, Pennsylvania. Good memories of favorite places. I remember one just not too recently nearby whom, having to have gluten-free, I asked about the French fries and were they done in the same grease that other breaded things were done in. And the proprietor said that, yes, we do use the same grease over and over, but if you'll come in early on Saturday morning, we change the grease and you can have some as a first batch. So I've yet to take them up on that, but we'll get together on that someday soon. Here's one titled Save the Last Dance for Me. Two strangers met, danced, and then went their separate ways. This is by Ben Schroeder of Newark, Illinois. By the end of my senior year, 1961, everyone at Crystal Lake High School in Crystal Lake, Illinois, was preparing for senior prom. Most of my classmates had chosen their prom partner except me. Several days before prom, my friend Keith told me that his date knew someone who wanted to go, so I agreed to go on a blind date. My friend talked to his dad into letting him use the family car, a posh white Cadillac, sure to impress. We arrived at my date's house, and I walked up and rang the doorbell. A tall, well-dressed man opened the door and asked me in. When I saw my date walking down the stairs, I was entranced. She looked like something like Princess of Monaco, Grace Kelly. Her father said something, and all I remember is nodding my head. After arriving at the high school, we had our photo taken. The entire prom with dinner and dancing lasted until about 5 the next morning. A picnic followed later in the day. I have many happy memories of our blind date on this wonderful night. But who is the girl? I would like to meet her again. Contact me at, I can't even give you that because I don't think we should give away the email address for private people here. But anyway, it was a good story there, Ben. Ben Schroeder from Newark, Illinois. Hope by chance someone knows Ben and the wonderful young lady that he has escorted to the prom. So we'll see what happens there. And talking about another get-together by some folks, the title of this one is Driven Together by Merlene Goodrich of Delta, Colorado. She had a Camaro, he had a Charger. Ain't love a gas, as the title goes. She writes, back in 1970, my parents helped me buy a green 1967 Camaro RS. I love shifting gears and feeling the power of the 327 engine. It was a good thing. I was working, and as keeping my Camaro in gas was a challenge. Know that. With its four-barrel carburetor and the way I enjoyed speed, the fastest I ever went was 110 miles an hour. And although the car could go faster, I lacked the courage to push it. One Friday night, I was dragging the gut, which was our term for driving up and down Main Street in Canyon City, Colorado. When I stopped for a red light and looked over at the car beside me, it was a 1969 white Dodge Charger that was looking real good and with a very handsome pair of hands resting on the steering wheel. The driver looked over and met my gaze. I smiled and he dipped his head slightly. At the next red light, he asked me if I'd like to ride with him. So I parked my Camaro and got into his Charger. There was an instant rapport between us, and we ended up talking till 3 a.m. I had to be at work at 5 a.m., so we made a date for that night. Then he went back to Fort Carson, where he was stationed, and I went home to get ready for work. I was so excited. I never felt tired. I worked my shift with wings on my feet. His name was Dale, and we began keeping steady company, never running out of things to talk about. He could always make me laugh, and my whole world just sparkled. We loved our cars. So many of our dates included adventures with our cars. One afternoon, we were driving back to Canyon City from Colorado Springs, and I decided to see if he could keep up. The road was fun, the sky clear blue, and I was laughing as he stayed right on my tail. I glanced down at my speedometer and noticed it registered 90 miles an hour. I looked up to see had Dale dropped back and that the cop was behind me with his lights on. Feeling foolish and doomed, I pulled over. The officer walked up to my car and, pointing back to Dale, asked, "Is that fella bothering you?" "No, sir. No, sir," I said quietly. "I know him. We're friends." The officer went back to his squad car, and I got on the road again, driving a sedate and legal speed the rest of the way home. Dale and I became serious, much to my parents' dismay. They didn't approve of him and thought they could get me to change my mind if they took away my Camaro. They were paying the insurance on the car, as my paycheck wouldn't cover my rent and car payment, plus insurance and necessities. But I didn't even have the key. I didn't even have to think about it. I handed over the keys. This October, Dale and I will celebrate our 46th anniversary. I never had any regrets. Now from the short memories section, Protecting the Privy. This is by Shirley Jupp of Blair, Nebraska. After my sister and I had left the family farm in Wheeler County, Nebraska, and were teaching school, our parents still kept a few milk cows there. One Halloween in early 1950s, our teenage brothers attended a party at school, so the milking chores were left to Dad and Mom. It was an unusually balmy evening for the late October, and our parents sat down on the bench outside the house to rest a bit after milking. As dusk settled in, a couple of skunks ambled up to the milk pails and began drinking. Mom did not care for skunks that close to the house and asked Dad, "Shall I get the gun?" "No," Dad replied, "I don't think I could see well enough even to hit them. I'd just blow a hole in the can." The incident was nearly forgotten until the following Sunday. It was a quiet time for the service at our Presbyterian church when a neighbor lady sidled over to Mom and whispered, "Did you really want Gilbert to shoot the boys, did you?" "What boys?" Mom wondered. It seems one of the woman's sons, another 12-year-old boy, had planned to pull a few tricks in our yard. They were discussing tipping over the privy when they overheard my folks' conversation about the gun, thinking they meant to shoot them. Those boys took off as fast as their legs would go. By Shirley Jupp of Blair, Nebraska. I reckon so. How about Grandma Got a Handful? Christine Smith of Richmond, Utah, writes, "My husband Stuart's grandfather, Arthur Smith, was a tease, and Stuart's grandmother, Maud, loved to be teased. Stuart's family lived with his grandparents in Clifton, Colorado, and Stuart loved to be around Pa, as he called his grandfather. One day, they discovered a nest of mice. Pa called Stuart over and put the baby mice in Stuart's overalls pocket, and then told Stuart to go to the house and tell Grandma to get the apple out of his pocket. Stuart did as he told. When Gran put her hand in the pocket and, rather than an apple, felt the squirming baby mice, she let out a scream as she frantically tried to get her hand out of the tight pocket. Meanwhile, Pa was on the back porch looking through the window and having a hilarious time watching the show. Thank you, Christine Smith of Richmond, Utah. From Eyes in the Sky Spies, Helen Krikorian Jones of Manchester, New Jersey writes, In 1944, my friend Marion and I were immersed in our freshman year at State Teachers College in Jersey City, World War II touching our lives, but still remote. The shortages and blackouts seemed tolerable compared to what we heard on the radio and saw in the movies. Our priority was to please Professor Rosengarten by earning better than passing grades in astronomy. So there we were, up on Marion's roof, equipped with flashlights, star charts, notebooks, and pencils, searching for the brightest stars in certain constellations. We were still looking when Marion's sister, Louise, approached us with a grin. Following her were two air raid wardens. "These gentlemen are here to investigate you," Louise said. "They got a call from New York. Your flashlights going on and off look like spy signals." I bet that was funny a bit. Helen Kerkorian of Jones of Manchester, New Jersey. Thank you. "Mules Were Machinery." This is by Audrey Spanour of Clinton, North Carolina. Anybody know Audrey Spanour in Clinton? Title of her story is "Mules Were Machinery." Mules were the machinery. Well, I know. These men, all from Taylor's Bridge area of Clinton in Sampson County, North Carolina, were cropping tobacco back in 1937. They were Blevin Mathis, now 81 years old, Jack Mathis, now 78, and Doodle Mathis, now 84. Doodle and Blevin are brothers, and Jack is a cousin. The mule would pull the tobacco drag, and the boys would crop the tobacco and put it on another mule to take to the barn. Over there, the women tied the tobacco on sticks and hung it in the barn to dry, with the help of oil heaters, before the crop went to market. When Doodle wasn't cropping tobacco, he was in the kitchen making black walnut cakes. Even now, he is famous in our county for his delicious cakes. "I'm a neighbor and good friend who has enjoyed her fill of those cakes," by Audrey Spanour of Clinton, North Carolina. And if you've ever been a farmer doing tobacco with using mules, you certainly remember that time. And now that industry's changed a lot. It's all mechanized. So that's Audrey from Clinton. Thanks very much for your report into Reminisce Magazine. Here's a story from the Coming to a New Land segment. This is a story from the 1950s on some immigration. The new homeland in 1952, a dream of following opportunities was realized by Michael and Anna Smaley and son Misha, and Anna, who also has a daughter now and four grandchildren. Story comes about and the title, "Waiting for Their Ship to Come In," and a sudden illness took the wind out of the refugees' plan of sailing to America. The story goes, they write, "We were in Germany in 1952 when my husband lost his job as a journalist. Being refugees from the Czech Republic and with another job prospect non-existent, the only solution was to go to a refugee camp with our five-year-old son, Misha. A week later, our friend Tony stopped by. 'Hello, you Americans. How are you?' My eyes must have told him, 'No jokes, please.' But he laughed louder and said with twinkling eyes, 'Your visa came. We're sailing from Bremen on August 15th. The dream of many refugees at that time, a new permanent home in America, was to come true for us. And at a time like this, it seemed God was really on our side. We left Munich for the afternoon camp in Lisum. The afternoon of our arrival, we took the train into Bremen and spent the last of our money on shopping. Shortly after we returned to our barracks at Lisum, Misha complained of a headache and an upset stomach, too. Too much excitement, I thought. As I put Misha to bed, he was trying to say something, but no words came out. Suddenly, his body stiffened, and he had a violent convulsion. The attack lasted only a second, but the Polish women sharing our room ran to get my husband. An American doctor gave Misha a careful examination. He explained that because of Misha's seizure, we must now get permission from the American consul in Bremen to immigrate, but the consul was taking a 3-week vacation. As night fell, the sounds of laughter and singing came from the street. Lots of Germans were celebrating the last night in their homeland before sailing to America. The next morning, the boat left port and the camp was deserted. Never in our life had we felt so lost. Life in the hospital where Misha stayed was comfortable. One day, a huge man appeared at the door of our room. Without any greeting, the man said, "You no go to America. You boy crazy in the head." I was so startled that I could not answer. I later learned that he was an unfortunate like us, a Russian refugee whose son had a 104 degree fever. Other occupants at the hospital included four Italian children whose mother had died and whose father was in Canada. The oldest was Victor, who was 6, and the youngest was 11-month-old Vera, whom I loved immediately. I held Vera in my arms, and Victor gave me an approving look, but he became jealous when I brought my son in. I can see now how desperately he wanted my affection. One morning, the Italian children left to begin their long journey to Canada, and the time came for my husband to visit the consul. Sympathetic and kind, the consul promised to do everything in his power to approve our immigration. A psychology test was arranged for Misha in the next 2 weeks. August had come by and September was waning when we made our final visit to the consulate. The doctor found Misha bright, intelligent, and best of all, ready to immigrate. Authorities secured 3 berths on the Groot Beer ocean liner of the Holland American Line. We sailed September 22nd from Rotterdam, Holland, and arrived in New York City on a golden afternoon, October 2nd. Living in America, Misha and Michael adjusted quickly to life in America and spoke English within the first 6 months of school. At age 11, he appeared on the television show, The $64,000 Question, where his topic was baseball, and he won $16,000. He married and had a daughter and is living in Michigan, and he has controlled his neurological disorder with medication. My husband, Michael Sr., and I initially worked as cleaners at the United Nations. I stopped work in 1956 when my daughter Jane was born, and my husband got into the hotel business, eventually becoming manager of the St. Regis Hotel in New York City. Michael Sr. died in 1976 at the age of 55. And I started working at Bloomingdale's when I retired after 17 years. Eventually, I moved up to upstate New York to be close to my daughter and husband, and her husband, watching their 3 children while they worked. That was truly the happiest time of my life. What a great story of immigration in the 1950s. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. I'll be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.